shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match there. Well, at night it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer. This is Comics Therapy, episode 14, no reviews, just analysis. We are so excited for our extended interview on the couch this week. We're only discussing two comics from October 23rd, 2013. Daredevil number 32 and Sex Criminals number 2. You know the drill by now. We don't do reviews, but we still may talk about a book to give key developments away, so consider this your weekly spoiler alert. And as for our esteemed guest, well, earlier this week, we spoke with Eisner Award-winning writer and artist Terry Moore, and we can't wait to share it with you.
Hey, everybody. This is Jessica Boyd from Comicosity at Charming Red on Twitter, and my nerd confession is that when the fake geek girl meme was going around the internet, I got very upset about it and the people who were using that term, so I decided to write a rap song that I actually recorded with background music, and even made a music video for. Needless to say, it was not one of my best moments, but the worst part? I actually handed it over to Aaron Myers. What are you gonna do? There's nothing I can do about it. It's out of my hands now.
Driving down the road with my Wonder Woman cup. Got my Spider-Man shirt on, my hypocrisy, it sucks. Don't care about your 80s continuity because I got Walking Dead on Blu-ray DVD. Work out every day because Lycra fits so tight. Mixing Linda Carter in New 52 hype. My account is empty from trade paperback binge. Wanna rock some Halo but gotta sew on this fringe. Some call me fake, while others see me as a slut. I call myself a mom and a comic book nut. Others are daughters, students, and wives. Fake geek girls just living our lives.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say as serious medical advice. The theme of the show this week is life in the big city. The rat race pace of the urban sprawl got you down? Perhaps you should try something more unconventional to belay your boredom, like dressing up in costume, or sex, or both together if you're into that.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions and nerd stories. We want to celebrate the little geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. Share them with us, and we'll share them on an upcoming episode of the show. You can call, Skype, or email your story. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
And in between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers, and of course the show account, at Comics Therapy. So Aaron, I unfortunately know the answer to this already, but how was your week?
My week's been incredible. What are you talking about?
Oh, really? Are you on vacation or something?
Yep, I'm on vacation from anything other than work.
Yeah, sounds awesome.
That's all right.
Yeah?
Some weeks you just gotta work.
Right. Maybe next time when you have a crazy week like that, we'll just, I don't know, put the out to lunch sign up on the show site and not record anything.
What about all our hundreds of thousands of adoring fans? Hmm. How would they live? How would they go on?
Right.
It requires personal sacrifice. We knew that going into the show.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay. Well, you are vastly more dedicated than I. Good job, I guess.
Well, I mean, but really, like, comics and recording the podcast are my escape from sometimes a very busy week of work. And there's been a few busy weeks lately. It's boring. Everyone has to work. Big deal.
So, I don't.
Well, that's because you live a life of a kept woman. I don't know what the, like a real housewife or something.
Yeah, I might have to edit that part out.
Well, us men have to go to work.
Oh, God, you went there.
You set me up.
I did.
And this has been a particularly busy week of work, but next week should be a little more mellow, hopefully.
Okay.
And I still have comics to read, and I read a bunch of those.
Good.
Luckily, I'm where we get a lot of preview copies, so as a little behind the curtain, I usually read our independent comics that I pick up every week ahead of time, so by Wednesday, I've already had those read. There's no way I can read 30 to 40 books on a Wednesday.
Does it ever feel like a chore?
Not really. Like, I like to read, and I like to read comics, so it doesn't really feel like a chore. And
I skip half of the content, so it's probably easier for you that way.
Well, let me finish one thing at a time, though. Uh-huh. So comics are an escape at the end of the day to decompress a bit.
Right.
Now, to go to what you were alluding to, we were just having a conversation about...
It was not a conversation. It was totally an argument.
I mean, I understand. It's nice. I think if you're reading 5 to 10 comics a week, you've got time to read all the letters columns and the back matter and summaries and things like that. Even when I was not reading as many comics as I am now, it just never really interested me that much.
You're missing half the story.
That doesn't make any sense. Okay. That's like saying, well, if you don't watch the credits to the movie, you're not really watching the movie.
Hey, did you know that at the end of Marvel movies, there's like an extra scene or two?
Yeah, so after the movie ends, I go on YouTube and watch somebody who recorded that little scene, so I don't have to sit through all the names.
You, my friend, are a crime against humanity. Right there. Yeah. You are.
I am an efficient nerd.
At the expense of missing out on, like, really excellent additional content. And I'm not just talking about Nowhere Men, which we discussed at length last week. I mean, any of the recap pages for, like, current books, like Young Avengers or Sex Criminals, that are fun and witty and add to the story, or anything that helps with pulling out points from continuity, like the longer running Marvel titles. I'm sure that DC does it too. You're just missing that. It's weird.
So like all the Marvel books that you read, you do all those little augmented reality symbols?
I don't do all of them, but I do quite a few of them.
You don't do all of them though? But what about the stuff you're missing?
You cannot turn this around and make it my deficiency. This is all you.
No, I think it's just a matter of how you like to enjoy comics. Like
I like to enjoy the entire comic. I don't just read some of it.
Okay, well, let me put it this way. Also, in a movie, I never want to see how it's made. Like, I never want to hear director's commentary.
Oh, God.
I never want to see the making of, ever.
Is this, like, a fundamental difference in, like... Well, yeah. I don't actually need to answer that. This is a fundamental difference in the way that we approach the enjoyment of media. It's fascinating.
To me, it's escapism. I don't want to see behind the curtain at all. Like, I don't want to hear, for the most part, I don't want to hear the author's thoughts about writing the character or the story. That takes me out of it. I don't want to see how they CGI'd the battle scene, you know, on a field or something like that. It's like,
I'm just going to put this out there that... When we talk to creators every week, that's exactly what we're aiming to do.
Not really, because we're not talking to creators about how they write, what goes into writing a particular series. Not really. I mean, maybe we have it here and there, but really my goal when we're talking to creators is to find out about them as people, and that's interesting.
Okay.
But I don't really want to... And it's different... I think it's different after a series has ended for a while.
Okay.
Like to go to, for this week, talking to Terry. It's interesting to find out more about Strangers in Paradise, because Strangers in Paradise has been done for a while. It's completed. I'm not in a monthly mode with that story.
Okay.
Rachel Rising, we didn't ask a ton of process, like behind the scenes stuff about how that book is getting written. You know, and we asked some things, but not enough that it ruins it for me. But I really wouldn't want to sit down with him and tell me everything you have laid out about this story or everything you think about for this story.
Oh, I agree. I'm not looking for spoilers, but I'm just making the argument that when you gloss over the supplemental content, you're missing context. And that makes me sad for you. That's all. I am so just looking out for you, Aaron. I want you to get the best comics experience, and I kind of think you're not.
I understand what you're saying, and I think you're correct to a certain extent that yes! there is value add in some of that, but there's also a distraction from that, and I never really feel compelled.
Okay.
Like, I don't want to read the letters column.
Yeah, I skip that, to be honest. I do.
I don't care about a recap unless I don't remember what the story is about.
But what if the recap is doing more to further the story than to just recap what had been told already, and you don't actually know that?
Then, in my opinion, that's a failure on the writer's part.
Oh, God, no! Okay. Yes, we're going to have to table this, because I don't think going to let this go, but we need to move on.
Okay, that's fine.
Why don't you tell me something good about what you read this week? You ready for Inner Child?
Sure.
Okay. Each week, I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply or argue about, as the case may be. 90 seconds, one book, one new comic from the past week that we are not analyzing. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
What do you think the chances are that I'm ready with the buzzer?
Zero.
Go.
All right. So this week, yesterday, I got in the mail the latest issue of Heavy Metal Magazine. And are you familiar with that at all? Don't waste my time. Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. So for those who aren't, Heavy Metal has been going since 1978, I think is when the first issue came out. It's a collection of sci-fi fantasy magazine. It's had some of the most amazing creators of the modern time on it. And it's pretty adult a lot of the time, too.
Are we talking about sex?
We're just talking about, like, robot porn. So that was my first, like, real, like, not main Marvel or DC book that I ever got when I was a kid.
How old
And
are you?
I just picked it up. I saw it was, like, comics as I flipped through it, and I asked my mom, can I get it? I was 13.
Oh, my.
Then I took it home and closed the door for a while because it was full of a lot of boobies and robot porn and everything else. So there's always been a place in my heart for Heavy Metal since then.
You got a new issue this week?
Yeah, Heavy Metal was my sexual awakening.
Oh, man. This particular episode is probably going to put us on the map, dear.
I guess so.
Well, okay, tell me about this issue.
Nothing particularly amazing other than it's just a fun thing that always kind of harkens back to that younger, more innocent time. So 13-year-old Aaron really likes Heavy Metal, so 35-year-old.
Time's up, thank goodness, because I'm not sure that I actually wanted to hear more specifics about what 13-year-old and 35-year-old Aaron actually enjoy about Heavy Metal. But
there's probably a story in Heavy Metal that is pretty close to what that might be.
Oh, man.
Well, you want to talk about some comics from this week?
Yeah, let's talk about the one that's not about sex first. I need a break.
All right, fine.
This is Matt Roberts, MR_Oberts on the Twitters. And you know what? I love comics. Love them a lot. Don't really give a shit about sci-fi. Don't watch Doctor Who. Don't watch old Star Trek. The ones are kind of cool. I like the new ones. So what? Anyways, yeah. Don't give a shit about sci-fi. Have a good day, everybody.
Our first book this week is Daredevil number 32, written by Mark Waid, drawn by Chris Samnee, and colors by Javier Rodriguez, and lettering by Joe Caramanga. Daredevil is published by Marvel Comics.
So the recap that I'm going to give for Daredevil is from the recap page, which
boring.
I know all of you read, but for Aaron's benefit, riots broke out as a result of the Bainwood verdict when D.A. James Priest allegedly called for mob rule by revealing the names and addresses of members of the jury. Daredevil soon arrived on the scene in an attempt to break up the mob rioting. It's now believed that the ones behind the riots are the Sons of the Serpent, a white supremacy group rumored to have infiltrated various levels of the New York justice system. There you go.
See, how is that helpful? I've been reading the book. I know this.
In this particular case, it's for somebody who hasn't read the book, who might be encouraged to read the book by us bantering about it. So maybe you should calm the fuck down.
Fine. You want to talk about Daredevil? Let's talk about Daredevil.
I like this book. I took a break from this book. I really shouldn't have.
No, this is great. This is one of the best books Marvel puts out. And we are far from the first people to tell people this.
Exactly.
But, so, let's talk, can we talk about Daredevil in general first?
Yeah, of course.
Were you a Daredevil person growing up? Like, is Daredevil your guy at all?
No, you know who my guy is, and it's not Daredevil.
Well, you can have more than one guy.
I do, and neither of them are Daredevil. In fact, all of my guys, none of them are Daredevil.
I would say I've enjoyed Daredevil more probably since this run, and there's definitely some great Daredevil stuff that I've even discovered that's older, but really kind of discovered in the last couple of years. But Mark Waid's Daredevil is like the Daredevil that I'll always love.
Yeah, I agree.
And the only way I can explain it is I like fun Daredevil, and I never really loved like intense Daredevil.
Yeah, I think I probably agree. I think that there is something about his play-by-play. All of his narration is a little bit pithy, a little bit self-deprecating, and fun at the same time. And so I think that those are all character qualities that I tend to find appealing.
I wonder, like, this is getting away from the book completely, but is that a mode of current comics, like, that we're kind of tired, or maybe we're, like, you and I, we're tired of...
We're always tired, yes.
Well, yeah, I know, but we're tired of, like, heavy books?
Does that make sense? Because you really like the heavy themes in, like, the big epic events or the epic titles like Avengers,
But that doesn't feel... That's, like, heavy in a battle sort of way, not heavy in a, like, emotionally, like, heavy kind of way, if that makes sense. Like previous incarnation of Daredevil, like, under Bendis...
He was really angsty.
He was very dark, very angsty. And it wasn't that there was a bad book. I mean, it was really there was some really good stuff in there. But it's depressing, too.
Right.
And maybe it's just the phase of life I'm in right now. I really gravitate to the happier
books. Well, so then how are you feeling about Hawkeye right now? Because a lot of the conversation that we've had about that book is that it's been so overwhelmingly depressing. As we look at the same story from multiple angles, and it's just like a bummer to read and yet so beautiful.
Yeah, but it has humor too. It has dark humor
whereas the old Daredevil was missing that.
Yeah, it wasn't funny.
Yeah.
You know, like you need to have the outlets. It's okay to have a heavy emotional story, but you have to have some sort of catharsis and release too.
Right. And I think that there's a good balance with that. Right now, with this particular run, there are some major issues being addressed almost like Law and Order style, pulled from the headlines, with the case that the jury returned the verdict and the not guilty verdict, right?
Yeah.
And the race riots and the issues there are very like current and very serious and very urban, and but it the balance with the humor and I think that the self-deprecating tone is actually one that we're finding a lot in these solo books.
Yeah, even in like Iron Man, I guess Hawkeye too,
Captain Marvel.
Yeah, maybe it's a current style of writing, but I mean, it really works. I'm wondering if in like in a year we're going to be like, oh, I'm so tired of like the kind of the silliness and the kind of the wink at the camera and that sort of thing. So maybe it's just us as readers, like we need that shift in tone every, you know, X amount of months or we start to complain about it.
But I think that it makes them, and I've said this about all of those other characters that we just mentioned, it makes them more human. Like you kind of remove them from the superhero world and it's like this guy who's got a lot of problems and is aware of them and aware of how powerless he is to fix all of them. But, like, let's just focus on this one thing right here and see how he handles it. So mm-hmm. I think that that, especially in the context of a, like the larger city with all of the other people and problems, like Matt Murdock tends to get more involved in different types of problems because of his day job, right?
Right.
And so this title showcases that the city is teeming with life and teeming with death, and he's kind of in the middle of it. And so the narrative style showcases that in a way that I think is very appropriate.
Yeah, and I've always struggled to wrap my head around the street level versus the big picture heroes, if
yeah.
that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, these tiers we've got of heroes. And I think ultimately, I think I gravitate towards the big picture because those are usually more epic stories.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes down to it, if I think about things that I really identified with and connected to, it's probably the street level heroes.
Right.
Because they're dealing more in fantastical ways, but there are these great stories of them dealing with kind of real life problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you still have the superhero stuff tacked into it, but there's more of a chance to kind of connect and empathize with what goes on.
Yeah. And there's been a couple of issues of Daredevil recently that have felt more like villain of the week style.
Mm-hmm.
So that he can be more street level without connecting with the bigger picture. Not that he doesn't belong in the bigger picture, but he's not an Avenger right now. So, like, that's the primary focus, I think, when you talk about bigger picture in New York City in terms of superheroes, like, that's it. That's what's happening. So when he's away from that, I don't know, it feels, like, differently more real.
Yeah, well, especially this last issue here, you know, it's just, it's not only, like, the city boy going to the country.
God, that was amazing.
Which is, yeah. But it's also, I mean, it's layers upon layers because it's the blind man
sure.
out in an unfamiliar territory.
The
and
transition,
it's the monsters
like
the, versus the people and everything
the
else.
The first panel where it was like, Kentucky, ha! Mm-hmm. That was comedy. I enjoyed it.
No, yeah, I mean, if we don't, it's like almost not even worth saying, but obviously, like, Mark Waid, he knows how to write a comic book.
Yeah, he kind of does. I think that kid's going to go far.
Yeah, he's, so, I almost am willing and I'll pre-order any book that has his name on it these days. Stuff I don't love and don't keep forever, but it doesn't mean it's not a well-executed book.
So this is going to wrap up in 4 more issues.
Yep, it's sad. But that's a pretty good run, too.
It's a great run. What do you think is in store for Matt as a character, though?
I don't know. It scares me because you can't do the same thing if you're going to relaunch it with a new volume.
Right.
I don't know what Marvel's kind of next phase ideas are, too. It could be really good, and it could be really interesting if it's their plan in terms of, like, merging entertainment, you know, division with the comic book side. He could have some place in sort of, like, you know, the Marvel universe that they're building on the movie side.
Are you talking... Okay. So you're...
So it could be that's the book... Also, you know, Mimic is preps for that, which could be good, could be bad. You can't expect it to be the same, and you can't expect it to be the same level.
Yeah.
Like, this creative team, they get it. You know, it's one of those perfect kind of matches.
Mm-hmm.
And when it first started, you didn't think it would be, but that first issue, when I read it, I'm like, what is this? This is not at all what I was expecting, and this is terrific. And that was... I hadn't been reading superhero books again for that long when Daredevil started up again.
Yeah.
Like, I had been reading comics for a while, but I had kind of the opposite, where a lot of people will come back to comics and start reading, like, Marvel or DC, because that's what they're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I didn't read really any superhero books for, like, the first couple of years I started reading comics again.
And Daredevil was one of the first?
Yeah, I remember that being one of the early ones. Like, I started, because I was like, okay, number one, you know, try this, you know, you jump on those. And that, so I have a stronger connection to that, especially since I'm far more invested in the Marvel universe than I am the DC universe right now.
Right. Isn't everybody?
No.
No, it's shocking, but they are There are definitely some adamant DC fans out there that we probably alienate like almost every week. So sorry,
well,
guys.
I don't mean to alienate them. I don't fault or, you know, if you love DC, I love that you love it.
Right. I just can't necessarily keep up with you enough to talk to you about it.
Yeah, it's just not what I'm connected to right now. I'm sure there'll be a time when it flips. That it always does. It seems to take a decade or so. Just right now, I'm really into what Marvel's putting out, not so much into what DC's putting out.
Right.
I don't know. This is a weird week for weird debates or weird discussions. But anyway.
Why don't we talk about sex instead?
Yeah, let's do that.
Hey, this is Carl, a.k.a. Camarillo Brillo from the Twitter, and I'm calling with my nerd confession. I absolutely hate the fact that heroes can be in multiple titles and have no reference to one another, especially when they get into, you know, earth-shattering crossover event-type tie-in books, and in their other titles, they seemingly are completely unaware that anything is going on beyond street level. And I would say that more often than not, the worst culprit of this is Batman. That guy is in so many books and has no connection to what's going on between one and another. His canon has the most convoluted and required the most blind eye of any hero that I've ever seen. So, anyway, confessed. Later.
Our second and final weekly comic before we get to the couch is Sex Criminals Number 2, written by Matt Fraction, with art by Chip Zdarsky. Color flattening by Christopher Sabella and production by Drew Gill. Sex Criminals is published by Image Comics.
So
ahead, read your recap.
I'm not going to read it because it's so long, but it's so brilliant. Aaron didn't read the recap in Sex Criminals Number 2. I know that everybody else did because it was so lovely. Here's a little snippet. Previously, page 1 and 2 were pretty cool. There were a couple of attractive characters named John and Susie making out in a washroom, but there was also a mysterious person demanding that they come out, and you can tell that person is weird because the lettering was all white on black, like how the Sandman talks. Page 3, it's like, what? And suddenly we see a guy fall to his death after killing the dad of our main character, Susie. She's a little girl, and it's in the past, and the adult version is there breaking the fourth wall and our concepts of time by talking to us from the scene in the past. Weird. Etc., etc. It's just straight up Matt Fraction being Matt Fraction. I kind of love it.
Oh, it's great. I already read 32 pages of Matt Fraction.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I read like 64 pages because of Satellite Sam, too. I don't feel like I'm missing that much if I missed one page of Matt Fraction.
Okay.
Anyway. I feel it's almost like we're coming to this book prematurely.
Yes, but it's okay because it's so fantastic.
And it happens to everyone, right?
Yes.
You see what I did there?
I do. It's going to be like that for the rest of this time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I'm a 13-year-old boy and trapped in a 35-year-old man. I told you this.
Yeah.
Earlier in the show.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yep. So anyway, let's get back to the story.
Okay.
I think this is a pretty cool premise.
Agreed.
I think this story relies heavily on sexuality as a titillation.
Agreed.
I'm fine with that, though.
It's cleverly done. It's not as base as it could be.
Yeah, I think, well, what I was even trying to say right before would be more like, if with a lesser writer, this could be really poorly executed.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a very strong creative team to pull off a story like this with the kind of script that they're writing to.
It's surprisingly high concept, given what is actually happening, and very tongue-in-cheek, and that is a combination that I think is like near the top of my dream list of tone for stories, not just in comics, but just in general.
It's super identifiable too, even though it's about people who, when they orgasm, time stops.
It's about the colors, dude. It's totally about the colors.
Well, it's really about sexual awakening,
right? And time stopping.
Yeah, that's the hook, but really it's about figuring out who you are, finding somebody you connect to,
right?
However, whatever that is, and living a life together.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. It makes me really happy. I want to tell you the story, and I've been debating about telling you the story. Mm-hmm. And if it freaks you out, I will edit it out. But here's my hook.
Okay.
So I see colors too. I always have, always. It took me years to kind of catalog them.
Wait, you see colors when you orgasm?
Yeah.
Okay, not just in general.
Not, I mean, I see color all the time, like a person, most people does,
right.
do, right? But no, like I have a whole order of color depending on intensity and have always experienced sex in that way. And about 3 weeks before this book came out, I was describing that order to somebody and very like explicitly kind of laying it all out there. And then when this book came out, my head exploded because what? I have never had that conversation with anybody who had a shared experience. And then last week, there was an article in IO9 about synesthesia. And the article, and I'll put it up on the show notes page, is called What Color is an Orgasm? And it's looking at synesthesia, if you don't know what that is, it's a way that certain people experience the world by making connections with unrelated senses.
Yeah, so, like tasting colors or
exactly,
smelling or sounds.
Color
like
and
that.
Music is really common.
Uh-huh.
And so it was a study that was looking at the way that anybody suffering from synesthesia experiences sex. And I'm like, oh my God, here is exactly what I would classify my own experiences as.
But is that the only case that you in your life that you can describe as having that kind of, you know, that transposition?
Like color is very strong for me as like an artist, but I wouldn't ever consider myself in some way experiencing other things in my life in a weird like color only way.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much just sex.
Hmm.
But it is incredibly intense, and I didn't realize, like I went through two phases. I didn't realize that other people didn't, and then I totally realized that nobody else does.
Yeah, now I feel like I'm missing out. All I ever have is like a sandwich afterwards.
No, there's all these levels depending on exactly like what was involved, and that's not the part that we're going to actually talk about, mind you. But now I feel like I have to reconfigure this like worldview, because obviously it's not just me. There's like fucking comics being written about it, and I think that is awesome. So it is possible that I am not objective at all about this book, because immediately when I looked at it and the colors were right, dude, they were purple. It was awesome.
Weird.
No, it was great. So
no,
immediate
not weird
connection.
Like you're a weirdo, just like it's an interesting experience.
Yes. But, like, now I cannot not be excited about this book. And so it's not entirely fair to recommend it to anybody else, because it always comes with the caveat of, like, oh, no, no, but then also when they have sex, there's color. And then, you know, I do look like a weirdo.
Yeah, but as an impartial, outside, non-color scene orgasmer, I can say that it's still a good book and people should read it.
right.
So, you know, I'm the control group.
You are the control group. And I need to emphasize the fact that I cannot stop time. And that is a bummer, since apparently that's like the ultimate.
Yet. You may yet be on the eve of your sexual awakening.
I'm 34. I feel like I'm pretty solid in that regard.
I just wanted another excuse to say sexual awakening. That really should have been the title of the show.
No, because, well, at least right now, Daredevil's not really seeing much action.
Yeah, but you could always find, you know, the job of a good reviewer is to find connections where they don't exist.
Luckily, we don't review.
That's true.
Yeah. So, back to sex criminals.
Yes.
I have to say that the kind of pre-hype for this book in no way prepared me for the direction that it is going. And that's fine, because it speaks for itself. I am concerned a little bit. Maybe actual sales will kind of squash this concern. But when you have a title and a premise that is so, like, playfully in your face about sex, it can turn people off. And especially when it's something so, like, loaded as the term sex criminals, which is, you know, clearly, again, quite tongue-in-cheek, given what we've seen Susie and John do. But, yeah, I just hope that, like, if people aren't reading it, they don't see it as somehow, like, just debauchery. Because it's not. It's much, much smarter than that.
Yeah, yeah. But that's also trusting in creators.
Oh, yeah.
Too. These kind of books, it's not a Marvel book, it's not a DC book, it's an independent book that you have a following for, and you know, the people who know you will pick it up. And then it gets buzz, too. That's just how, you know, with the internet, people will say, hey, this is the book you should be reading, and then people will.
Was there a buzz about that, like, positive buzz this week, because it was, like, not approved by Apple?
Oh, I didn't even hear that.
Oh, for real? Yeah.
I've been working. Do you remember that part?
Right. God, man, you gotta get out and, I don't know, read some comics and have some sex or something. Last night, Matt Fraction posted that it was, or I don't know, maybe it was 2 nights ago, that it was, like, delayed by Apple. So it wasn't available through the Comixology app.
Mm-hmm.
It was only through the web or through Image directly, and then obviously at your local shop.
Right.
And the last couple of times that's happened, there's been quite an uproar, especially because of the way that it was communicated. But I didn't see that this
Yeah,
time.
I think that uproar engine is still in refactory period.
Yeah.
It's, you know, after a couple of times it happened and the explanations for it, I think that kind of burnt itself out.
Right.
Which is good, because...
But the alternative is that sometimes there's good buzz about, like, oh, this is an amazing book, so here are all the alternative ways to access it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, true. But I haven't seen anything today on... like on Twitter or anything
but
else.
You were working, so.
I was working, yes. So maybe, maybe not. I think this book will do just fine for an independently published book and
yeah.
the audience that it goes for, because you can't hand this to anyone under, I don't think anyone under, you know, 18 is going to even appreciate it, because it's dealing kind of with adult, you know, adult story.
Agreed. But I think that, like, there's nothing wrong with that. It's
no.
It's about sexual awakening. I'll give you that. But
yes,
it's about
it.
It's about reflecting on that as a much more mature person.
Yeah.
So it's, in a way, it's less about, wait for it, sexual awakening, and more
mm-hmm.
about kind of processing your sexual experiences as an adult and looking back on what led you to where you are now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's looking back on figuring out all those feelings you had when 13, when you accidentally got a copy of Heavy Metal as a adult, and being able to kind of laugh about how awkward, you know, life was then.
Oh, you're still so adorably awkward, Aaron. Don't worry.
Yeah, but sexually, I am a panther.
Yeah, but you don't see colors.
Well, no. Panthers see in black and white. We still know where our prey is.
Man.
You ready to move on to the couch?
Yes, I am. I have been excited about this since we talked to Terry, and let's do it.
Hi, Comics Therapy. This is my nerd confession. After many, many nights of progressively more and more difficult and intricate board games with my dude bros, it culminated in the popping of my Magic the Gathering cherry with two guys at the same time, no less. Turns out, those board games were just cleverly disguised gateway drugs, and my addiction process is now complete. The confession part of this is that it was so much fun. I got home, shut my door, and in the safety of my own room, I said to myself, that was so much fun. Ah, shit. Because I knew that what happened today was inevitable. I bought my first starter deck of Magic cards, and I'm actually excited about it. But whatever. Love the things you love. Anyway, the end. Thanks for the podcast. You guys are awesome. P.S. Sorry I sound like a man. I'm in the middle of recovering from a cold.
This week on The Couch, we couldn't be more excited to welcome Eisner Award-winning writer and artist Terry Moore. In addition to stints on several notable titles at Marvel and DC, Terry is known for his three self-published series, Strangers in Paradise, Echo, and the currently running Rachel Rising. We talked about Rachel Rising and gender roles back in episode 8, by the way. Today, we're going to chat with Terry about making comics his way, what he'd take with him to a deserted island, and, well, everything in between. Thank you for joining us, Terry.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Before we get kind of started into the meteor stuff, can you talk to us about what you're working on right now, besides, obviously, Rachel Rising? Other comics projects, TV projects, movies, spaceflight, things like that?
The only other outside thing I have going on right now is that Alcon Entertainment is trying to develop a Rachel Rising television show. And I'm encouraging them to do that. They acquired it last year and then made an announcement earlier this year that they were going forward to into development, which doesn't mean, you know, it's coming on air. It just means we're throwing money at it and time at it. So
I mean, that's exciting, though. So many comics properties these days get purchased, but nothing ever happens with them. You know, not even to the development stage. So, I mean, that's encouraging that they're moving forward.
And I've certainly had my share of experience with that. It's interesting options because that's what happened to Echo. A guy got it and kept it for a couple of rounds of options, but now it's back on my desk again. And, you know, that's typically the norm that, you know, people acquire these things just to get them off the market, or they, you know, it's an impulse buy. It's almost like all these indie comics are sitting at a register somewhere in Hollywood, cash register, and they just pick them up like gum, you know, then decide later if they want to mess with them. So
is Rachel Rising at a different later point than Echo ever got to?
Yes.
I've
never been this far with any project.
Awesome. How involved are you in the conversation?
In the conversation, I'm very important, but in the day, I haven't done a thing. You know, they're working on a script, and I'm not involved in that. So I'm very anxious to see how this all pings back to me, how another smart writer looks at it and gathers it together for a television format. So, you know, there's just something weird there. You know, it's kind of like sending your kid off to camp.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in what my kid looks like when I see them next time.
Oh, a little scared though too, right? I mean, that's
Yeah, you know, because I've seen fan fiction of my stuff before. That there was a script written for Echo that was just awful. So yeah, it can go really wrong. But I think the thing about the only control I ever have is being careful who I pick to turn loose with it. And I think I pick really good people to, you know, turn loose. And then once you've picked them, you've got to trust them and you got to let them go do their thing. You know, I, for instance, if I were to get some big name guy to pick it up, somebody that we all know, I certainly wouldn't call him and tell him what to do, you know? So you got to feel that way about your producers and the people who pick you up. And I'm feeling like I'm in good hands.
That's awesome. That's very encouraging because I think we've talked a lot, and I've certainly seen other people comment on how episodic Rachel Rising is. It lends itself to our imagination working quite well in the television medium. So if you have faith in who you've passed it on to, then it's encouraging for the rest of us to have faith that it's going to continue to develop in good hands.
Well, that's good. I mean, if we all get a positive vibe, maybe it'll resonate in the universe and make it so. Maybe we can make a butterfly effect out of all this.
That sounds like a good plan. So what is a typical writing day for you, or what is a typical drawing day? Or I guess maybe more specifically, do you segregate your actual writing and drawing activities in that way?
Not too much. If I'm really stuck on plot, I will sit down and be a writer with my keyboard. But if I'm feeling good and I'm connected with the story, then I just sit down and cartoon, meaning I write and draw at the same time.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and cartooning is like being a singer-songwriter. You know, you pick up your instrument and it just all happens at the same time for you, the creative person, you know, versus, you know, sitting down with a keyboard and writing a story is kind of like sitting down and just writing a poem with your guitar nowhere in the room. So it's a different discipline. And but when I write, of course, I know where it's going. So I'm writing. If I write with a keyboard, then I'm thinking of, OK, how am I going to play this? How am I going to draw this? So I'm writing for my cartooning needs. But typically, I'm just a cartoonist. I start at the top left of the page on a blank page and I work my way down.
And that's all things you've learned from prior to doing the independent comics and doing the comic strips, I'm assuming. That was your work process.
Yeah, I learned it in high school when we started drawing a page of panels so we could tell a short sequence story. And to be honest, you know, I was 15 years old and we were drawing these little toad characters that were funny. And the toads would get blown up or drive off a cliff in a Volkswagen Beetle or something, which we thought was funny. And I discovered that it was funnier if I set it up with a few panels. And then it was even funnier if I set it up with a two-page sequence, you know, where there was a page with maybe seven or eight panels on it, and then the second page where it all happens. Mm-hmm. And I got bigger laughs. So by having that direct daily marketing, test marketing with my friends, I figured out sequencing, how important sequencing was, and developing and having patience. You know, a lot of times with cartoon art, what you really want to do is draw the payoff panel. It was all about that one panel. It was your idea. And then you discover that you need 12 panels in front of that to really make it work. And it's the discipline of learning how to do that and getting the setup just right. It's a little bit like learning how to be a video editor, but it's all from the same planet, you know.
Well, it seems like it's a big evolution of writing itself, that to learn the anticipation, the buildup to the payoff, it seems like it's something that takes a while for a lot of creators to learn. That you don't, exactly. The reveal, you know, the slow burn is often more rewarding than the instant gratification.
If you think about, say, for instance, O. Henry stories or Edgar Allan Poe stories, the whole point of the story was on the last two or three pages.
Right.
Every page ahead of that was just something you needed to know. And that's exactly how it is in the comics.
So do you take notes about dialogue or the actual text as you are drawing? Do you refine that a little bit later?
Yes, constantly editing. If I think of clever little dialogue lines, which happened a lot when I'm working with people like Jet or Kachu, because they're quick-witted and, you know, they have sharp tongues. So when I would think of something, I would jot it down, and a lot of times it did get used. So, and then I'm always, once I'm writing, I'm constantly changing it. And even after I ink, and even after I Photoshop it, and even after I lay it out, I'll read it back again. And if the dialogue doesn't flow well, I'll change it, you know. And
so it's, you read it out loud to yourself?
I'll read out loud sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. And when I'm reading this finished work back, to me, it's not really locked down yet. It's not locked down until I have to send it away. But I'm looking at the finished work like a director looks at a final play rehearsal. And if we can move somebody around and make it flow better, you know, if anything catches your eye when it shouldn't, or, you know, if there's a stumble in the flow of the dialogue, that kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. I love that. My background is in theater, and I constantly talk about how the storytelling process in comics and the storytelling process on the stage is very similar to me. They both feel very organic in their discovery, and so it's sort of wonderful to hear you make that analogy with the development of your own work. Do you listen to music ever while you're working?
Yes, constantly. Having this musical background, music is really key to me. It makes I love having soundtracks to my life and to the years and what stage I'm in. I definitely have soundtracks for each of these books. You know, I listen to different music now than for this Rachel than I did for Echo than I did for SIP.
Yeah, that makes sense because thematically they're very different.
There were a lot of times in SIP where I was listening to like Enya or something. And then when I was working on Echo, I was listening to Metallica. And when I started Rachel Rising, I was listening to Marilyn Manson.
That almost seems a little too on the head. I have a question. So we've talked about sort of your work day, but what do you do when you're not working? Like, I know those days are probably few and far between, but how do you spend your off time?
The only off time I get is when I travel to a convention. Mm. When I'm home, there's always a book due. So I work 7 days a week. And we kind of have a lifestyle that's just developed around me being the cartoonist. You know, I wake up, eat, hit the studio, and then break for meals. And I work till about 2 in the morning or so. And then I get up the next day at about 9:30 and start over again. And that's kind of my routine. That's how I've managed to make all these books over the last few, 20 years. Wow. So it's not really a job. It's a lifestyle. In order to keep from, to keep up, I go out a couple of times a day to go get my Coke and, my Coca-Cola.
Right. I was going to say, with that schedule, that could mean a couple of different things.
The cons are when I socialize and things like that. And then Twitter try to stay in touch with everybody's blogs and YouTube feeds and everything like that. And so I have a heavy media blitz on me every day. So.
But that gives you a little bit of a breakup between the staring at the page and drawing, like having at least the internet as a way of getting the distractions throughout the day.
Yeah, I'm kind of a loner, but I'm not living like a monk. I'm not cut off from anything. I'm keeping an eye on everything.
So if you could, then what would be your dream vacation?
Wow.
Or is that so far out of the realm of possibility?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't even imagine that. My wife Robin and I have certainly had some wonderful times where we've been in some beautiful places and just enjoyed the day. So I certainly know how to appreciate that. I have a favorite hotel in Hawaii that where a little band plays at sunset Hawaiian songs, and a former Miss Hawaii does the hula dance, and they serve you these wonderful drinks, and you can watch the sunset over the bay. It's so there's places like that that I found a couple of Shangri-Las on the planet that I like. Mm. So I'm always happy to get a chance to go back to those places.
Excellent.
Yeah, there's just some pretty places. And even in America, I've seen some gorgeous places in America.
Well, like Hawaii in America, right?
Yeah. But, you'd be surprised. I have seen some gorgeous places like up in, when you get out the countryside of Illinois and Utah and places like that.
Oh, yeah.
Pennsylvania can be gorgeous. Mm-hmm.
Well, so you've given us a little bit of a sense of how you feel about solitude. Just with your work schedule. So if you were heading off to a deserted island, it can even be Hawaii, that's fine, but just by yourself, what are the three things that you would take with you? Think impractical. You don't have to waste your things on survival items. I will grant you this deserted island with modern conveniences, but I want to know what you would take to occupy your mind.
Do I have any idea how long I'm going to be there?
Let's call it indefinitely, but you will get home eventually.
Okay. I will take my, I would like to have a Coke machine there, please.
A constantly refilling Coke machine?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And
I'm sensing that this is a very important part of your routine.
If I run out of Diet Coke, I stop working.
Oh.
And I will go get another one. And I have actually been so desperate for a Diet Coke when I was stuck at tables at cons that I would tweet, if somebody brings me a Diet Coke, I'll give you a sketch. And I would get a Diet Coke within 5 minutes. And I was so grateful. That's what the internet's really for. It's not about problem solving for global issues. It's for, bringing me drinks.
Okay.
So anyway, I've got my Coke machine and I would have... some my drawing supplies and then my guitars. And then I would be happy. I wouldn't be able to tell the difference between that island and this studio.
Would you bring a book? Do you have time to read ever?
I do have time to read, and I might have time on that island. But, you know, if I don't have room for a book, I'll just make one to read. That's what I did with SIP. I was looking to read a book like that. I couldn't find it, so I drew it for myself.
That's awesome.
So Andrea and I both have kids, and we talk a lot about what they may or may not grow up to be. What did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a creative person who could, not have to work 9 to 5.
Was that always the goal? The arts were always just in your blood?
Yeah. I remember being like less than 11 years old and playing a game where I was drawing pictures on a deadline and somebody was taking the pages from me and, turning them in. And God, it's so amazing how that worked out. I just never wanted to work 9 to 5. I knew I didn't fit in.
Well, what did your parents do?
Well, actually, my dad was a creative person. He was a director for film and television. Hmm. And that's what he was doing when I was growing up. My summer jobs were always working on film crews and commercials and things like that.
So you were always kind of exposed to the creative process, especially the business side of it.
Yeah, and especially the people, because that's a different kind of people. They're all kind of theater-oriented people.
Yeah.
A lot of big personalities and a lot of delicacy of how you work with people, how far you can push or not push creative people, and how to get, 30 people organized to make something gorgeous. So but that was the kind of things I saw my dad do growing up. And he also did some theater. But
it's so interesting that you saw such a collaborative side of the creative process, and yet you do a lot of your work independently. So it's mm-hmm. not collaborating with a writer or collaborating with an artist or obviously like on a much bigger scale, like film or television or theater.
Well, if I have to be honest, I would say that I love the outcome of an ensemble effort, but my work and my creative ideas are actually coming from more of just a singular writer vision. Mm-hmm. I always felt more like the person who would write the material as opposed to the person who would stand up and deliver it. So that's kind of a loner thing. My heroes were individuals who produced the script or the play.
I never wanted the actor necessarily.
Yeah, I've never wanted to be the actor. Because even when I was a kid, I knew I didn't have that. I wasn't that kind of person. I didn't have the physical qualities or the charisma or the personal, confidence. But I knew that I did have an ability to look and comprehend what I was looking at. I could see what was going on in the room and explain it later. So that's all you need to be the writer, really.
Can I ask just to go like kind of looking over? I was just kind of going through your works again today. Refamiliarizing myself. And when you have done kind of the mainstream or other people's books, like say Fables. You did an issue of Fables. What was the decision to, okay, I will draw this one issue, or I will take this project outside of my own work?
On Fables, it was because I was asked by Shelley Bond, and she's a good friend that I've known for years, and I've always wished I could do something at Vertigo with Shelley on the book, because she's such a champion of creative people.
Uh-huh.
So Shelley gently twisted my arm, and I said yes immediately. And there's always the hope in the back of my mind that if I did some of these outside projects, that more people would discover me and that I make books. Because being indie, you're always playing to the indie club. And once in a while, if you can share the stage of these bigger acts, it helps.
Right. Yeah, that absolutely makes sense.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Rachel Rising for a minute. Can you talk us through the research that goes into writing a story that is so steeped in religious mythology?
Well, I have to tell you, I'm doing no research.
Oh, that's awesome. Are you serious?
Yeah. I just have a head full of it after having lived my whole life reading a lot.
Okay.
So it's just stuff coming out of my head from a mix master in my head of, you know, I've read a lot of books cover to cover from all the angles and everything. And I just, it's all one big, it's all one big stew to me. And then it comes out like this. And I'm fascinated by not so much the details of each camp and each side of these big, you know, life issues. I'm more fascinated by the movement through society over the centuries, how it alters and shifts. Mm-hmm. What's acceptable, right? What's acceptable 100 years ago is totally unacceptable now, although the fact of the matter never changed. So it's the people that shift and rotate around the subjects. And that's, to me, in writing Rachel, where I'm dealing with people who are approaching the same these same topics from 300 years apart. And then you have somebody like Lilith, who has seen every different opinion over this over the lifetime of humankind. To me, that's just fascinating, you know.
Yeah.
If you sat down and discussed religion with somebody from 1690, you would be amazed how at the basic differences. When you're talking to people before the dawn of the earth sciences in the 19th century, you know, things like that. So you have to take all that into account when you're writing these dialogues.
Yeah, pre-scientific discovery, religion was science, and you know they were inextricable. That it was the world, and there was nothing outside of it.
Yeah, you know, it's and that when you think about how deep that runs through the decisions that were made and everything, you know, it's a pretty serious thing to reckon with. I mean, you have to consider that when you're figuring out how the code of people and their conduct back in the day.
Yeah. Aside from Rachel itself, and kind of go to all your works and your style, you know, you are known for your female characters and how they're drawn, and you seem really at peace and to have mastered that balance of beauty and realism without crossing the line into cheesecake. And is that something you've been conscious of over the years, or is that just something that's always naturally evolved? Like, how did you decide on your character looks, your character models, and where to kind of to keep it within reality and not take it to the next level, to the next point?
Well, you know, I don't know how much conscious decision there is to that, because if I drew more cheesecake, I think I would sell more books. So I've always regretted that, you know, I'm always thinking, why don't I do that? But I just can't bring myself to do it. Because I can draw these women characters that then become very real to me, then I feel like their family or girlfriends or I don't know, I feel connected, and now I feel responsible not to embarrass them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, even talking, you know, in these last 20 minutes of how you talk about your characters, they seem like very real people to you.
They have to be. If you're, you know, you can analyze things as characters, but if you're creating, your writing will never have any spark of life until you stop thinking of characters and start thinking of them as people. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you that Linus and Lucy were very real to Charles Schulz, and Kachu is very real to me. So, you know, that's how you do it. And that was really my epiphany to switch from work that was very, I don't know, the work that had no life. The stuff I did in the 80s had no spark. And then I suddenly realized that they were people. And I began thinking about what they sounded like, what they smelled like, how they walked. And it just, everything changed for me as a creator. So, and I'm sure actors do the same thing. You know, you get a role and they're not thinking, okay, I'm going to plug in character 2B3. I'm going to think about this guy and how they dress and talk and all that, you know?
Well, it's very apparent. Like, I just got the Strangers in Paradise on the bus, and I've been kind of rereading through it from the beginning. And you can see that evolution of how I think the characters, when they become real to you, the art style also gets more refined. Maybe I'm projecting onto this, but I can see that there's this manifestation. And as you get more tied as the creator to the characters, they become more real on the page.
I kind of did. Yeah. That was there. And also the sillier they got, the more cartoony it became. And then it would go back and forth at will. I actually was consciously doing that because I was thinking about how different we look as people, whether we're being serious or whether we're being really silly at the moment. You can look at pictures of your family over the years and say your relative may look so different in 30 different pictures, depending on what year it was and what mood they were in. And, you know, take a picture of somebody when they first wake up versus when they were, you know, on a date and that kind of thing. And I, as an artist, I love that variation. You know, actors love that variation. They want to have as many looks as they can on a character. I always thought it was a problem with comic book artists who would master one look and then stick with it. You know, you flip through 200 pages and there's no variation. On the one hand, that's good to generate iconography like Superman. But if you're going to write a book about reality, you know, it's really good if your character wears different clothes every day. Stuff like that, you know. Putting those things into your story helps with setting and sense of place.
Can I ask to kind of go back to this too? I mean, maybe this is a very personal question, but why are you so drawn to female protagonists? Like, what is it about these women that you've created that's manifested themselves for you? Why have they come into the world as opposed to a male, you know, a male main character?
I have to think. I've been asked that a lot, obviously.
I'm sure it's not. Yeah, I'm sure it's not a new question.
But I always try to answer it as honestly as I can, because I think I wish more people would share the view. I write about women because I actually just think they're wonderful. I think men and women are really two different species. Women walk on this on a different planet than we do. They have a different life experience. And it's just, to me, once I began to notice that, I began to see the courage and the different type of bravery and commitment, and the goals were different, and looking at conversations and arguments and problems differently and some different solutions and all that. It just became fascinating. And it happened at the same time that I was becoming really disillusioned with mankind, because you know, we're the ones that start the wars and build the guns, and you know, we're the ones who do the stalking and all that kind of stuff like that. We're the violent ones, and so it kind of all happened over a 10-year period, and I kind of switched from this guy who had always liked women to becoming more actually something of a feminist. These days, you know, the older you get, the less strident you are about things like this. You realize the world is too big for any one opinion. It's all too complicated for one stance and one point of view. So I really, my bottom line now is just simply, I think there are enough stories about men and what men do. I think there are not enough stories about women and what women do. You'll notice, though, in my books that it's not like I want to live with women 24/7. You notice that my women never sit around and talk about their families and the kids, and we don't go shopping or we don't stand around and cook too much. You know, I'm not into that. I'm a guy writing about women, so I'm taking women and throwing them into the same action problems as Arnold Schwarzenegger. But I just find it interesting that if somebody had to do something really wild to fix the problem, well, instead of the muscle guy in the room ripping his shirt off and doing it, how about that girl over there on the couch do it? You know, that's a lot more interesting to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that is one of the strong angles of your books, is these female characters that don't get highlighted enough, and showing how they can be the same level of hero that we see with male characters, but doing it in a female way.
And actually, the whole premise of SIP was that it was a traditional love triangle, but I miscast it on purpose. So you've got Kachu saying all the James Dean lines, and
right.
David, the guy, is actually the sweater girl. And then Francine is the third wheel, you know, and trying to make it all work.
Right. Yeah.
And you don't have to answer this if you're not comfortable with it, but what are you afraid of? And has that evolved over the years?
I think I'm most afraid of living and dying and nobody noticing. That if I were to die, you know, within 3 years, it doesn't matter. You know, the day you die, that afternoon, there's still going to be a traffic jam and they're still going to, you know, play the TV shows and all that. That's kind of depressing. I always thought it was depressing that Mozart was dumped into a mass grave. So, you know, it's there's always there's a part of me that wants to leave something behind that I was here. You know, there are certain people throughout history that we know they lived because of what they left behind. And I think that's been part of the motivation for me to spend my whole life working to make as big a catalog of books as I can to leave behind. That's my legacy.
Do you see that desire for legacy reflected in the choices that your characters make also?
In the sense that they are going through small steps, through big issues. Mm-hmm. The legacy that I hope remains is the themes that the books dealt with. If you look at the themes being dealt with in Rachel Rising, they're really, if you ignore all these extraordinary physical circumstances, it's really people discussing the viewpoints of faith versus science versus maybe there's a third option that we're all ignoring because we're too entrenched in one camp or the other. Mm-hmm. One of my pet peeves is that the human race tends to always pick two sides. So it's always one extreme or the other. And that as I've gotten older, I've gotten less patient with that. I think both camps are stupid and there needs to be a third option.
Well, on a lighter note, what comics should more people be reading? Obviously your own, but besides your own, what are you reading? What turns you on these days? Or what would you recommend to people if they said, hey, what should I read?
I would recommend you check out European graphic novelists because they're fantastic, and a lot of them come from classical art training, so the art is gorgeous.
Yeah, I was just talking at the Rose City Comic Con to Richard Starkeen and Tim Sale, and the only thing I'm really European mainstream that I'm very familiar with lately is Black Sad, and that's where we started talking from, but they obviously have a much bigger exposure to it, and they were just going on and on about all these European artists and how the European style is so different than the US, you know, the mainstream market style, and the creative process is so different too.
It is, and it's admirable in the sense of their artistic approach to the work. They will spend a year making 80 pages, and I have to make 80 pages every 2 months,
right,
to survive. So it's a different approach, and you get a different kind of work. You'll get lush backgrounds and cityscapes, things like that. They take great pride in it, beautifully rendered. And so, yeah, I was in Europe once with Tim Sell for the weekend, and we had a great time going through the bookstores, and he was talking about Black Sad to me, too. So
maybe it's his personal crusade.
Every time I pick up a pen, like a Micron pen, just draw, I always think of the Europeans, you know, mm-hmm. because their line work and things like that. And then when I pick up a brush and start brushing stuff, I start thinking of, you know, Canadians and American new wave art styles, things like that.
Yeah.
But before SIP, I went through 2 years of just looking at Japanese stuff and finding a lot of favorites there. But that's a very expensive vice because, like, for instance, one time I was reading a series called Sanctuary by, I forget. And the main story was about political intrigue. And then there was a subplot between a Yakuza and a female police sergeant. And I was buying these books that were like $8 a piece just to find out what was going in this 3-page subplot every book. Mm-hmm. And I realized I had spent $80 reading this series, and I still hadn't found out if they're going to get together or not. And I realized, okay, I can't afford this.
Yeah, some of those manga series, they'll go on for 20, 30 volumes at $15 to $20 a piece.
Yeah, you know, and but I learned a lot. Oh, Ikigami was the artist. I learned a lot from the artists and their work ethic and things like that. So, you know, it's one of the things that's been tricky to learn over the years is the dedication required to keep doing it. So looking at people who work very, very hard, like the Japanese or some of the Europeans who have dedicated their life to, you know, how many pieces of art they can produce that they're proud of, you know, that's where I find my working inspiration, not from talking about DC or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's over the last year or so, I've been buying up and reading a lot of Tezuka's books, which have been, a lot of them are getting republished these days, and they just weren't accessible in the U.S. But, you know, to look at his work, his breadth of work, and the amount of pages he produced over his lifetime is pretty unbelievable. And there are a lot of Japanese and European examples that way that are, you don't find a ton of examples in the U.S. or, you know, or Canada that do anything like that. Besides, like Kirby is probably, you know, the U.S. is equivalent to that.
Well, one guy who's a cautionary tale to me is Matt Baker. Back in the early 50s, he was the Adam Hughes of the early 50s in comics. Mm-hmm. But he worked himself to death. He was a wonderful talent, and he was popular, and he took the work. He never said no. Poor guy worked himself to an early grave. So I hope I don't end up like Matt, but I do want to have a long career where I can keep making books.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for taking the time with us today. Is there anything at the end here you want to share with us? Any last pearls of wisdom, diamond codes for Rachel Rising? I know, you know, we try to, with these interviews, I mean, we really do. We try to instill on people how important pre-orders are, especially to independent books, and how it really is sort of a life or death for a lot of these series.
Man, you're not kidding. In terms of like, will I ever make another one for you? It really does totally depend on book sales right now. Getting Comixology and getting digital sales has been a great addition to my income, but I'm still living off of the book sales. Mm-hmm. And it's very important. And, you know, the world always wants to constantly turn away. And so we're all, that's what they were saying about Miley Cyrus. That's why she's doing what she's doing is, because she has to get any attention in this day and age. But I can't do that, of course. I'm not going to ride naked on a comic, swinging comic book. But
you could learn to twerk. There's still time.
I have absolutely no comment on this whatsoever.
I'm not going to go there with you.
I'm telling you, if you want exposure, you got to do what it takes.
Maybe not that.
Some people do want exposure. But anyway, recommending books to your friends and things like that, and those indie support deals, and blogging about them, it sure does help. It really helps keeps them from forgetting. You know, a lot of people like something and forget about it. So thanks for the PR.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been obviously incredibly delightful to chat with you, but your books bring a tremendous amount of joy to a lot of people. So keep, maybe not so much with the twerking, just go back to the drawing and the writing. It seems like everybody wins in that sense.
Okay, I will. Thank you very much. Yeah, you guys ask serious questions.
Well, when we started the show, we didn't want to do a review show. And, you know, Andrea and I talked already about this kind of stuff, about books that we didn't really feel a lot of people got into. We didn't want to say, like, here's a dozen books from the week. Did we like it or didn't we didn't, you know, like it? And let's critique the particular, you know, inking style in this Marvel book this week. You know, it just, there's plenty of people doing that. And there are some really good shows that do it really well. And it's just not really my forte or desire. And we just wanted to take books that inspire us or at least give us food for thought and talk about them. And I think that's kind of even more important than whether it was a good issue or not. Is this a series that makes you think? I mean, I have a degree in English literature, and you know, Andrea has a you know, theater background. You have a pile of degrees.
That makes sense, because this was more like going on the actor studio. You know,
that is exactly what we talked about when we said, "Hey, maybe we should do some creator interviews."
It felt like that, because we were talking about, you know, more about, you know, how the motivation stuff and where it comes from, as opposed to, like, you know, what eraser do you use?
Right. Which, honestly, as an artist myself, I'm interested in, but that's not quite the same level of conversation that I think that we're, you know, heading towards.
Yeah, I that's why I like your show.
Thank you. I'm serious. That means so much.
Oh, good.
It's a lot of fun to put together. You were just part of really good conversations. So thank you again. This was awesome. Well, so thank you, Terry. And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. The show notes, including the links to some of the books that Terry mentioned, the episode archives, and details about submitting your nerd confessions and stories are on the website at comicstherapy.com. Till next week.